This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Leroy School Superintendent Gary Tipsword says the lack of state funding for so many years is one of the many reasons teacher numbers have declined. It's about perception.
When you feel successful, when you see positive things happening, you feel better about your job. It doesn't matter what your job is.
Tipsword says in part two of GLT's series Skipping School, Illinois might be turning the corner on at least one front. Eric Stock introduced you to the candidates hoping to become McLean County's next top prosecutor, and John Norton previews the local screening of a documentary about jazz musician Thelonious Monk. All that after a GLT News update. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Nearly 8 in 10 public school administrators in Illinois said in a survey last year their school has a teacher shortage. Most said they face a major shortage. In part two of GLT's education series, Skipping School, Eric Stock examines how money plays a part in teacher decisions to stay in or leave the classroom, and how it impacts administrators' ability to give educators the resources they need.
Brandon Oates is a 22-year-old from Poplar Grove near Rockford. Fresh after graduation from Illinois State University in the spring, he landed his first teaching gig at Kingsley Junior High in Normal, where he'll teach business and computer science. Oates taught grade school and high school students while he was a student teacher in Unit 5 schools last year at North Point Elementary in Normal Community, but he's never dealt with the unique challenge of instructing 6th, 7th, and 8th graders.
Yes, there is a lot of drama that starts in middle school. It's a very important time in the development of an adolescent, but it really is all about the trust and building rapport that's going to be key with the classroom management.
First-year teachers in Unit 5 who have a bachelor's degree start out at nearly $37,000 annually. It's one of the lowest starting salaries in McLean County, despite being the largest district in the county. District 87 in Bloomington offers the highest starting pay in the county at $38,000+. Oates says the pay had no bearing on his choice of school district or even his career choice.
Future educators who are looking to get into the field for a salary are probably not in the correct field. We don't go into this for the money, that's for sure. So that didn't really bother me at all.
Oates doesn't envision ever leaving teaching, but data suggests he's more likely to leave the profession before retiring than those who taught a generation ago. Unit 5 hired 200 new teachers and teachers' assistants for its 23 schools this summer. The district had to replace nearly 10% of its faculty. Some educators are retired, took other teaching jobs, or left the profession. The Illinois State Board of Education reports the state has turned over about 7% of its teaching positions each year for the past decade, so Unit 5 is above the norm. Superintendent Mark Daniels says that unprecedented turnover in his district is due in part to State Farm's recent job realignments, where many teacher families had to relocate. But he suggests there's also a larger cultural shift at play.
I think it's part of the millennial generation, millennial group. Historically, they don't stay in a position for their entire career. They tend to move and find different places and different locations and even change careers.
Daniel acknowledges teacher salaries and career earning potential can be a turnoff, specifically for teachers in Unit 5.
We knew that we were not competitive in regards to our salary schedule, so new contract, we had to revise that. We had to be somewhat competitive.
The district bumped its pay for first-year teachers 7% this year. Many educators believe pay has become a turnoff for prospective teachers. Ben Matthews, a field representative for the Illinois Education Association, recently attended a job fair at Illinois State.
It wasn't that long ago that the line at the Unit 5 table was out the door because people wanted to come work in this district. I was able to walk right up to the table this year and talk to the folks who were working there because there was no line at all. And it's because they would look at the starting pay and realize it was thousands of dollars less than what they could get elsewhere.
A survey by the Illinois Association of Regional Superintendents of Schools shows smaller, more rural school districts have an especially difficult time finding and keeping teachers. Gary Tipsword is superintendent of the public school system in Leroy, population 3,500.
If we opened an elementary position 10 years ago, it was not uncommon to get 75 applicants for that job. We've had elementary positions open in the last couple of years where we were lucky to have 10.
Tipsword is one of the architects of Illinois' new evidence-based school funding formula, which calculates school districts' funding needs based on nearly three dozen factors. Tipsword says the intent of the new funding model is to give teachers the resources they need to give their students a better chance to succeed. That, he says, could keep more teachers in the profession.
When you feel successful, when you see positive things happening, you feel better about your job. It doesn't matter what your job is. Right. So whether it's in journalism or whether it's in public education or whether it's in banking, when I see good numbers, I feel better.
Tipsword says in researching the funding formula, he came upon something he has already put to use in his district. He says students who were struggling to meet certain academic benchmarks but wouldn't fit in a special education setting benefit from what's called an interventionist, a tutor who is also a liaison between the student, parents, and teachers to help the student meet their goals. He has hired one interventionist to help students in the elementary and junior high at Leroy. Tipsword acknowledges teachers, especially entry level, should receive more pay, but he bristles at the $40,000 minimum salary bill lawmakers sent to Governor Bruce Rauner this spring.
They need to understand, and our public needs to understand, the implications to property taxes of a bill that was just passed in Springfield. And so some legislators in Springfield just told us in McLean County that you're potentially going to have to do something different with your property taxes. That seems like overreach.
Tipsword says minimum salaries in Leroy are close enough to $40,000 that a tax increase wouldn't be necessary. But for some small school districts that have much lower starting pay, a tax hike might be unavoidable. He says for teachers who are well below the $40,000 minimum, the district would need to sharply increase annual pay, which could run afoul of another state law, which caps pay raises at 3% in the final years of a career to avoid pension spiking.
And so if I have people at the end of their careers, you just pass a piece of legislation that is going to force me to potentially take a penalty,
which the school district would have to pay. Plus, Tipsword says the salary increases at the lower end of the pay scale would inevitably lead to more pressure to increase pay for the other faculty. According to the Illinois State Board of Education, nine school districts last year paid entry-level teachers less than $30,000. The lowest was in Farington, a small town near the Indiana border, where teachers start at about $26,700. In McLean County, the lowest starting pay was Olympia, at about $34,000. Next is Lexington at $35,000+. Then comes the largest school district in McLean County, Unit 5, which educates nearly half of the public school students in the county. Teachers there started last year at about $35,400. Unit 5's Mark Daniels says if the governor signs the bill mandating the $40,000 minimum, the district would likely need to raise property taxes.
I think Bloomington Normal understands the importance of educating their youth. So we will, but we'd have to go out for some type of revenue increase to cover that.
The governor hasn't taken action on the teacher salary bill. He has said teachers should be paid better. He also says the key to school districts' financial flexibility is reducing unfunded legislative mandates. While many teachers say they can live with a smaller paycheck than other professions, they are concerned about the uncertainty surrounding pensions, even after the minimum retirement age was recently raised to 67. Superintendent Tipsword says that will be impractical, if not impossible, for some teachers to manage.
The idea of a kindergarten teacher getting up and down with kindergartners and matching the energy of a kindergartner at age 67, those are remarkable people who can do that, and they're rare.
While the majority of school districts in Illinois say they face a major teaching shortage, many more of them will tell you they face an even greater shortage of substitute teachers. Neil Stasinski retired from IBM 12 years ago and now serves as a substitute teacher at Normal Community, Normal West, and University High Schools. He says he tried subbing at the junior high level, but found that wasn't for him.
You describe the girls as mean girls and the boys as stupid boys in junior high. And mean girls are only mean to each other. They aren't mean to teachers, at least, but stupid boys are stupid to everyone. So that wasn't something that I enjoyed having in front of me.
At 6'6", at about 260 pounds, Stasinski has a little trouble commanding the classroom, but he says earning students' respect right away is essential. He takes classes at Heartland Community College, in part to stay sharp on any of the various subjects he might have to teach. He makes clear to his students it's not a free period when he's subbing.
When I come into a French or a Spanish or a German class and I speak to them in the language that they're learning, they realize it's not a day off, and it disappoints the students. But also means that they don't try to get away with anything by talking in Spanish or French or whatever in front of me and thinking that I don't understand.
Stasinski says he finds substitute teaching intellectually challenging, but about 3 to 4 days a week is enough for him. He explains what frustrates him as a teacher.
The kids who have already given up on themselves or belong to gangs or into drugs or something, that can't always read the signs of when the kids are into drugs or when a kid responds to my classroom management as a challenge to his or her, primarily his masculinity.
Stasinski isn't teaching for the money. He makes between $80 and $105 a day, but he understands why that's a turnoff for some who might seek to sub as an entry-level point into a full-time teaching job.
As the pay goes up, the number of candidates will go up. And right now, the supply is low and the demand is high. But that comes and goes as the economy changes.
Unit 5 of District 87 offer the lowest substitute teacher pay in the county, $80 per day. U-High, Illinois State's Laboratory High School, pays the highest at $105 per day. The survey we alluded to earlier says a majority of school districts face a serious substitute teacher shortage, and most say the problem has become significantly worse in the last 5 years. It was about that time when the state increased the cost to become a substitute teacher and required them to pass a background check. Illinois Regional Offices of Education handles licensing for substitute teachers. The regional superintendent for McLean, DeWitt, Livingston, and Logan counties, Mark Jauntry, says he hopes the new evidence-based funding model will enable schools to not only pay substitutes better, but to better prepare them for the classroom.
Subs that go through some professional development that is provided either through our office or at the district level, to just kind of ensure that they're able to provide, you know, an adequate level of instruction and support in the classroom.
The state has also relaxed some guidelines for substitutes by reducing the cost of a license from $200 to $150, enabling candidates with 60 postgraduate credit hours, as opposed to a four-year degree, to sub on a short-term basis, making it easier for out-of-state subs to transfer their license to Illinois and allowing retired teachers to sub longer without jeopardizing pensions. If pay is a worry for teachers in the public school system, it would seem to be an even greater issue in private schools, where teachers generally make less. Karen Hertzner taught math for 1 year at her alma mater, Normal West, before the district planned to eliminate the job and transfer her to Normal Community. Hertzner suggests that's when divine intervention took over.
I remember praying. I was like, Lord, I have no time to apply anywhere else. So if you want me to, like, apply, I heard there was an opening at Central. You're going to make it happen. The next day, the electricity went out at Unit 5, and literally Unit 5 called it an act of God day. So I went and I applied at Central and I got the job.
Hertzner is about to begin her fifth year teaching geometry and algebra at Central Catholic High School in Bloomington. She says looking back, she's glad her job at West got eliminated because she finds the private school system to be far more liberating. Not only can she be more open about her faith in school, she's been given more flexibility to teach the way she wants.
If my students aren't, you know, ready for a test day or whatever, I can take an extra day. I have a lot of freedom with how I plan and with the curriculum and how I teach it, and that's awesome.
Hertzner adds teacher evaluations and professional development, while they still exist in the private school system, are far less burdensome, while class sizes are generally much smaller, too. Typically 20 students max.
I can handle this amount of kids. I can give everybody a lot of good attention during the day, and you don't feel like you leave class, shoot, I didn't talk to this person. Like, everybody gets your attention. And so, yeah, that's really, really nice.
Hertzner is currently on maternity leave with her first child. Her husband is an account manager for a Bloomington insurance agent. She says while it's more of a strain making ends meet as a private school teacher, finding joy in her job is most important.
We make a little less, but we just live by our means. Honestly, as a single person, it was totally easy to live off of that as well. But yeah, you make a couple cuts and sacrifices, but it was just so worth it.
Unit 5's Mark Daniels says while most of his teaching positions have already been filled, there's always a need for teaching assistants, as some classes have more than 30 students. Starting pay is between $10 and $12 an hour. With all the challenges that educators face, no one is predicting the Illinois teacher shortage will end anytime soon. I'm Eric Stock.
Tomorrow on part 3 of Skipping School on GLT, Mary Cullen reports on the pressures classroom teachers face and how those have increased in the last 20 years. You can catch up on other stories in GLT's series on the teacher shortage at our website, wglt.org/skippingschool. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Westminster Village, providing quality retirement living options in Bloomington Normal for more than 35 years. Independent living apartments and duplexes, licensed assisted living, and skilled nursing care available. Information at westminstervillageinc.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Just ahead, the political repercussions of helicopter parenting. But first, candidates for McLean County State's Attorney have been meeting with county board members in recent days to make their pitch for why they should be the county's next top prosecutor. As GLT's Eric Stock reports, the candidates had one chance to make a formal pitch as they were interviewed by the county board's executive committee.
The five candidates are Chris Graham, Jane Foster, Don Knapp, Mark Messman, and Jessica Woods. Each has experience in the state's attorney's office, though none are currently prosecuting criminal cases. Each is seeking to replace Jason Chambers, whom the Illinois Supreme Court has appointed as an associate judge. Graham, a Bloomington attorney and former prosecutor, had a scheduling conflict and couldn't attend the meeting. First up was Mark Messman. He joined the state's attorney's office in 2002. He's been working the last 6 years in its civil division.
So my point to you today is if experience and ability is what you want, then I think the choice here is clear. But don't take my word for it. Don't call my references and ask them if they think I'm great. I've already talked to them and told them to say that. I invite you, this board, to make some calls on your own. Call some lawyers, call some judges, police chiefs, call the former state's attorney. There's several of them in town. I'm not going to tell you which ones to call because I don't want them to be influenced. And don't ask them who their favorite is or who their friend is or who they'd like to see get the job. Just ask them what they think is important in a state's attorney. I think when you do, they're going to find out that somebody with a real thorough history and knowledge of prosecution is what the job needs.
Messman added his views on alternatives to jail have changed over the years.
When I was starting out and for the majority of my career, I made up my mind that I was going to be, lock the rascals up. Let's not worry about fixing them. Let's let them fix themselves. And, if they do wrong, we're going to lock them up. And if they want to stop the cycle of crime, they can fix themselves. Well, I've softened that over the years, actually quite a bit. I'm to the point now where I think those programs are absolutely crucial. It's been proven to my satisfaction. I'm not from Missouri, but you got to show me. And I've been shown that those programs work and they help and they keep people from getting into the system.
Jane Foster worked 12 years in the McLean County State's Attorney's Office before leaving in 2012 and running unsuccessfully for the seat that Chambers won.
The most important experience I got during my time in the office was trial experience, courtroom experience. I have spent hundreds of thousands of hours in a courtroom, presenting cases to a judge, arguing motions, and most importantly, doing jury trials. I've completed over 300 jury trials. That type of experience, that specialized trial experience, can only be gained by doing trial. You can't get it any other way. And to be an effective leader and an effective state's attorney, you have to have the practical courtroom experience so that you can share it with those that you are training and mentoring.
Foster recently worked 2 years in the Macon County State's Attorney's Office, where she supervised the gang and drug unit. She says that experience will help her to address what she calls an alarming and unacceptable rise in gun violence in Bloomington Normal.
I can take the fight against the small number of individuals in our community that are perpetrating this violence. I can take the fight to them swiftly, severely, and confidently from day one. I can walk into a courtroom and I can try that case. But in addition to being a leader in the courtroom, I can be a leader in the community. We need to come together as a community. We need to get social service agencies. We need to get the faith community involved, pastors, faith leaders, and come together and try to understand and address what is the cause of this violence and how can we stop it before it begins. I have experience in doing that. I can do that again.
Jessica Woods joined the McLean County State's Attorney's Office in 2007. She left to join the Town of Normal's legal team 2 years ago, then returned to the county as lead attorney in the civil division.
I have experienced both the civil side of the office and the criminal side, and have the breadth of experience and knowledge to do the job of the state's attorney's office. I'm the only candidate that has experience in that much of the office, including the civil side, and I'm ready to lead the office. In my time there, I have gained the respect of the employees, the attorneys, along with the support staff. I've gained the respect of the judges who I've practiced in front of and dealt with, and I've gained the respect and support of law enforcement, which is very important in the work that we do. And so based on all of that, I am the right candidate for this position.
Wood says she supports a holistic approach to public safety and reducing crime, saying she's an advocate for the various courts in the county which focus on rehabilitation.
What is best for our community? And it's not always to just ship people off to prison to teach them a lesson. It's sometimes coming alongside them in drug court or recovery court, veterans court, or probation, or giving people a break if there's mitigating circumstances to help people become good community members. But the state's attorney's office only plays a small role in that puzzle. We also have to have community buy-in, strong families, strong churches, strong schools, education, and also law enforcement that our community trusts, which I think we do have great law enforcement here, and then a state's attorney's office that's willing to work with all of those different subsets to achieve results.
Don Knapp recently moved out of the state's attorney's civil division to become assistant county administrator. He struck a personal note in explaining why he wants to become state's attorney, noting his father served as a police officer for 3+ decades.
I was fortunate enough in 1990 to do an internship with Task Force 6 and got to watch my dad work just a little bit, not very often, but just a little bit, and that was pretty special to me. So I concluded by saying the thought that I could continue my dad's work of protecting this community and maybe someday some cop's kid hears his mother or his father say my name with the same reverence that my father said those names that I mentioned is just an opportunity that I can't pass up, that I'd kick myself if I did pass up. But it's not just dad's good work that I'd like to continue.
Knapp says the county has provided significant resources to help address a fundamental question in prosecuting alleged offenders.
I truly believe in the notion, in the theory, that people do stupid things, especially kids, and every once in a while people do evil things. And we should seek to punish evil things significantly different than we seek to punish stupid things. So, and I, you know, had this conversation with a number of the board members, especially Susan, and I'll ask the follow-up question of myself, how do you differentiate between the evil things and the stupid things, right? Should my wife leave me, and many members in this room probably wonder why she hasn't yet, but should my wife leave me, and I go and I have 4 drinks down at Rosie's, and I get in my car and I drive to go get 4 more drinks somewhere, have I created a stupid act or have I created an evil act?
McLean County Board Chairman John McIntyre will nominate a candidate for the county board to consider next Tuesday. I'm Eric Stock.
The appointee will serve until the remainder of Chambers' term is up through 2020. After a break, John Norton will preview a documentary showing Friday at the Normal Theater about jazz legend Thelonious Monk. While you wait, want to know what you think of Sound Ideas and today's stories. Hop over to our Facebook page, we're WGLT-FM, or follow us on Twitter, we're at WGLTNews. Chime in on Eric's story about the state's attorney's candidates or our week-long series on the teacher shortage. A good place to start is WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas.
What looks like journalism these days sometimes isn't. At GLT, we answer to listeners, not advertisers or corporations. Listeners help pay for news and the reporters who cover the facts. Eric Stock, a 27-year news veteran covering Bloomington Normal.
Contributed to the recent spike in gun violence.
Mary Cullen, her last beat, the State House.
Frontier Airlines is coming back to Central Illinois.
Independent, financially supported by listeners. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from Heil Group, whose strategic planning and leadership development has contributed to transformative culture change within organizations throughout Bloomington Normal. Heil Group expertise and services bring out people's best, individually and as teams. Details at heilgroup.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. It's back to school time, and here at ISU, that means move-in is in full swing. Parents and their students lugging stuff up to the dorm room, and parents wondering just how much space to give their kids. A recent study shows helicopter-parented young adults are less likely to get involved in politics than their non-helicopter-parented counterparts. GLT's Mary Cullen talked with one of the authors, Illinois State University Assistant Professor of Political Science, Carrie Melita.
Melita says helicopter parenting can take place at any age, but it's excessive helicopter parenting that can lead to young adults losing their sense of ability to do things on their own. So what is helicopter parenting?
Helicopter parenting is, we also call it over-parenting, where it's this idea that a parent is doing things for their child that the child should be doing on their own. These are often things that are necessary for development, that are required for developing independence and being able to basically function in adult society. It's not a new thing. We've been talking about helicopter parenting really in psychology since the 1960s, but it's really just been this late millennial generation and newer where it's really become prolific and pronounced in society.
So I know the studies that you've done have focused more so on college-age students. Obviously, helicopter parenting, it starts off when you're a kid, but how do we see this change, and when do we see the change between taking care of your child when they're a toddler compared to overreaching when they're a young adult?
Yeah, so there's nothing wrong with parenting, right? You don't want your kid just to, you know, wander the neighborhood as a two-year-old, right? There's good boundaries and being protective of your children. But helicopter parenting takes it maybe a couple steps further. These include things like doing your child's homework for them, doing a project for them, requiring them, you know, to often with cell phones to check in every 10 minutes. Who are you with? Where are you at? And like I said, some of that is good parenting, right? Knowing where your kid is. But taking away all agency, taking away all independence is where you start to get developmental problems in children, which can lead to the rise of anxiety and depression later in life. And that's why I'm studying it in college students, is because when we think of helicopter parenting, we think of elementary school, middle school, maybe even high school. And the thing is that it doesn't stop when they get to college. It keeps going. And that's where you start to see these children who are adults now, right? They're young adults. And they should be demonstrating all the necessary independence and development of a young adult, but they aren't. Because not only have they been helicoptered, but they're still being helicoptered. So it's hindering the continued development.
Helicopter parenting isn't exactly your specialty. You work in politics and government here at Illinois State. So what inspired you to look into this topic? Why helicopter parenting?
I teach college students. And what I've noticed, purely anecdotally, is that it's gotten worse. When I first started teaching college students, which is getting always now, about, you know, 8 years ago when I was in graduate school, you maybe had one every year, a parent that would email you on behalf of their student, or if it's a really bad semester, maybe stop by your office, then you have to explain that due to privacy laws, I can't discuss your children's grades or anything with you. And then what I just noticed is it's just been getting worse. It's gotten to the point where I at least get two a semester now. Emails or phone calls from parents concerned about their child's grades or concerned about their attendance. It made me interested just because, well, why is this getting worse? Why is this? What's going on, you know, with college students today?
So let's get into some of your findings in these reports. I know the report shows that students who were helicopter parented are more likely to have conservative political views. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, that was one of the more interesting things that we found, is that college students that have, that were strongly helicoptered, we have this, we build this little index of, because it's not just a matter of are you helicoptered or not. There are degrees of helicopter parenting, right? You might just have a parent that likes you to check in a lot, but basically leaves you to your grades and register for your classes and, you know, you do you at college. And then there's some where we called extremely helicopter parented. These are students that have signed privacy waivers that allows their parents to communicate with their professors and school administrators, go with them to academic advising meetings, register for classes for them, remind them of exam dates, remind them to study. So there's a continuum of helicopter parenting. And what we found is that those at the higher end, the severely helicoptered, were much more likely to have authoritarian policy preferences. Things that like support for warrantless wiretapping or support for increased security, TSA at airports, independent of their partisanship. So this would be even a student that says they were liberal has these authoritarian viewpoints on these particular policy issues, which was really interesting, is that we controlled for ideology, we controlled for party ID, and it didn't matter. Helicopter parenting was still very strongly associated with having these conservative viewpoints, even among liberal students.
So the report also says that helicopter parenting leads to the development of an external locus of control. Can you go into explaining what that means, and if there's an opposite, what the opposite would mean?
Sure. So in psychology, we talk about every individual having either an internal or an external locus of control. An internal locus of control is typically development as usual. It's when something bad happens to you in your life, your first reaction should be, okay, so what actions did I take that led me to this situation? How am I responsible for this bad thing that happened or this thing that I want to rectify? Now, in contrast, developing an external locus of control is you attribute the fault to something outside of yourself. It wasn't my fault that I was late for the meeting, right? There was a traffic jam and I just didn't allow for time for it. Or it's not my fault that I failed an exam. The professor didn't cover the material enough. It's an inability to assess blame on yourself. And helicoptered students tend to have very strongly developed external locus of control, where they have what seems like an inability to assess themselves as being responsible for negative things happening in their lives. Whereas we contrast that with the less helicoptered or unhelicoptered students, which tend to have an internal locus of control. So that's what we really noticed with helicopter parenting, and we think is kind of the key to explaining why helicopter parenting leads to these different behaviors.
So after the research that you've done, are you able to look at helicopter parented students now and see how that might impact the future, either for themselves or for culture, just what those viewpoints might lead to?
Yeah, we're starting to see the first wave of strongly helicoptered people entering the workforce, right? And we're hearing anecdotes of having the parents do job negotiations or in a couple of really bad cases, having parents show up to the job interview with the student. And, you know, that's not good. I think that looking forward, as more and more of these people enter adulthood and enter the electorate and political science, I mean, unless at some point you stop helicoptering, right? And even then, you know, you hear anecdotes of like 30-something-year-old children, right? The parents still kind of acting as helicopter parents. And the interesting thing is we just don't know. We don't know what happens at a certain point. Do you stop helicopter parenting? And then how long does it take for those effects to wear off? But assuming that they either don't or they take time to wear off, we would definitely be looking at public opinion moving in a more authoritarian direction in the future.
Could you explain how a helicopter parented person could be less interested in involving themselves in politics?
Yeah, so one thing we've always seen with, we call them political ambition studies, is that young people don't like politics and young people don't want to run for office. And this is a generational thing. This is something that previous generations, when they were younger, they didn't have the distaste for politics that young people do today. And what a couple of my studies have looked at is that maybe helicopter parenting has had some role in this and in acquiring this either distaste for running for public office or just disinterest in it generally. And that is that we go back to this developing the external locus of control, right? It's this feeling of a lack of agency, a lack of independence, a lack of control over the events in your life and how they unfold. And what we're proposing in this second paper on helicopter parenting is that when you develop an external locus of control, you're not able, you just don't see running for yourself, running for office, as being something that would make any difference. Nothing you can do is going to change anything. You don't have control over the problems in the world. You're more likely to want to pass that off to the government to resolve, right? That's helicopter parenting incubates authoritarian worldviews. You're comfortable with the government doing it because you've been comfortable with your parents doing it for you your whole life. So by virtue of having that lack of agency, you're less likely to think that, well, what could I do that makes a difference? And that's, we think, really contributing to the fact that young people aren't running for office at a time we need them to the most.
And so, like you said, you say this is a time that we need them to the most. So what does this mean for the future of politics? What are we losing?
Well, we had hoped that our representatives in Congress and the state legislatures would become more descriptive of the populations that they actually represent. Right, Congress and the state legislatures tend to be whiter. They tend to be more male, and much older than the typical median demographic in the states that they represent. And unfortunately, I think what these findings suggest is that that's very unlikely to get any better anytime soon, because the very people that we need to be getting involved in politics are kind of being conditioned out of it at the same time. So a big part of it, I think, is going to be dependent on how long these effects of being helicoptered last.
An overarching view, I know you worked with a researcher that was not in Illinois, but the two of you working together, what are you seeing? Is there an increase of helicoptered parents? Is it stagnant? Are we at a plateau? What is the future prediction?
Right now, we hopefully have reached the plateau. And we've already seen kind of a reactionary movement against it with all the free range parenting. If we've heard of that, we're basically just let your kids go wander the yard. I think what most of us associated with a normal childhood, right, where you be back by the time the street lights turn on. So I think the fact that we're already seeing kind of a reactionary parental movement against it might be a good thing, in that maybe helicopter parenting has reached its zenith and we're starting to see that it is negatively affecting our kids. It's making them anxious, it's making them more prone to depression, and it's making them less participatory in politics. So maybe that we're finally seeing the repercussions of this and getting some reactionary movements against it. I'd like to think, my educated guess is that maybe we've seen the peak.
That was Mary Cullen talking with ISU political science assistant professor Carrie Melita about the impacts of helicopter parenting. GLT is a public service of Illinois State University, where a bunch of parents are moving their students into dorms this week. Quick check of the forecast shows they should maybe pack an umbrella, too. Showers and thunderstorms likely today, especially after about 2 o'clock. More rain tonight. Tomorrow, as move-in continues here at ISU, a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms and a high near 82. This is Sound Ideas. Illinois Wesleyan University jazz director Glenn Wilson says rare concert footage is a major reason the Thelonious Monk documentary is a must-watch. Wilson's nonprofit Further Jazz is bringing straight No Chaser, the Thelonious Monk story, to the Normal Theater screen for a Friday night showing. Wilson tells GLT's John Norton that Monk was also special and that he and Dizzy Gillespie were the two players at the forefront of what would become the jazz bebop sound.
His style is so interesting because he's not really like the other pianist at that time was Bud Powell in bebop, and Bud Powell was, of course, the fleet of finger, fast piano player, really just kind of the opposite of Monk, and Monk plays very deliberately and not afraid to play minor seconds and just dissonances on the piano, and, you know, people said he can make any piano sound out of tune.
You know, so. That's true. Well, I mean, am I wrong on this? Early on, he wasn't lauded by the critics, right?
Not by the critics. By the musicians, he was always very appreciated.
Why didn't the critics like him at first?
I don't think they understood what he was doing, and they couldn't appreciate the open harmony and the kind of pianistic style that he used. His early Blue Note recordings in 47 were now looked upon as masterpieces, but at the time they didn't really sell that well, and Blue Note kind of dropped him from the label.
Name of the movie is Straight No Chaser, the Thelonious Monk story. It's playing at the Normal Theater on Friday night. What can people, let's say someone who's not a jazz fan or a Monk fan, right? What can they take away from this movie?
Well, his story is very interesting because, of course, he suffered from some mental illness problems.
So that is addressed in the movie?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and, you know, some people thought he was bipolar, and he would get up in the middle of a song and just twirl around and dance and, you know, leave the musicians to play by themselves. That was pretty common. He would just, whatever he felt like doing. I have a couple of actually original Monk stories because I played on Lionel Hampton's band with Frankie Dunlop for a year or so, and Frankie played with Monk for 5 or 6 years.
Well, tell one story.
Do
you have one story you can tell on the air?
Well, I'll tell this
one. Unlike the Buddy Rich stories?
Right. Well, actually, this is an interesting story that has nothing to do with Frankie, but I did play a concert for Monk at the Baroness's house, the Baroness Panonica.
Oh, yeah.
Where Monk lived the last X number of years of his life. Paul Jeffrey was a saxophonist that played with Monk, and I had a big band. Paul Jeffrey was leading. I was in a big band, and so we took the whole band over to the Baroness's house, and we set up in the living room. Of course, she's famous for having hundreds of cats running around, so there were cats everywhere, and smell was kind of strange, as you might imagine. But the view was of the entire Manhattan skyline from New Jersey, you know. So Monk was in the other room. So we played this whole concert knowing that Monk was sitting in the next room, but we never saw him. He never came out. And Paul went in at the end and talked to him, and he came back out, and all he said was, "Monk dug it." So
that's a great story. You were in the same room as Monk playing
Monk's music.
Wow.
Yeah. And
how intimidating was that?
Well, I mean, we couldn't see him. He was in the other room.
But still, you knew he was there, right?
Yeah, was very interesting to know he was in the next room, and we never got to.
Well, you mentioned the Baroness. She was a Rothschild, and she was basically his benefactor and romantic partner as well?
Not that I know of.
Did that get addressed in this film, or does that get addressed, his relationship with her?
There is some of that in there, yeah. But, of course, she was a patron of the arts. Charlie Parker died in her hotel room, and she was a very strong patron of jazz artists at that time. Very interesting story about her.
Glenn Wilson is our guest. He's the director of the jazz program at Illinois Wesleyan University, along with a grant from the Harmon Arts Foundation.
Harmon Arts Foundation and the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation both chipped in on this series of jazz films that we're going to do for the next 6 months.
And the first one is Straight No Chaser, the Thelonious Monk story.
Mm-hmm.
This is pretty cool. You are also going to play after the show.
Yes, we'll have a concert as we've been doing.
Who's with you? And
Chip Stevens on piano, Matt Hughes on the bass, and Ricardo Flores on the drums. And we'll be doing, of course, all Monk music. So that'll be exciting. We're going to try to pull out some things we've never played before. Monk has some compositions that have been very rarely recorded and some others that have been, you know, amply recorded. So,
well, you brought in an unmixed, or is it unmastered CD?
Yeah, both.
So it's just going to be kind of raw, but it's something that you and Chip Stevens did.
just our duo that we've been doing for about a year and a half, and Chip has reharmonized some standards and some other tunes and some originals that we've done, and I'm really excited about the recording. I think it's going to appeal to people who just love beautiful music, but it'll also appeal to jazz fans who can really hear what we're doing with the music, which is a little more advanced than normally you hear these tunes done, so...
Wilson and Chip Stevens. Wilson on Barry saxophone, Stevens on piano from an album that is not even out yet. This is even mixed or mastered. This is kind of cool.
We just recorded it in late June. Yeah.
Where did you record it at?
At Tom Becker's studio here in town.
Okay.
On his 1854 Steinway.
How cool is that?
Yeah.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. We're talking about the movie Straight No Chaser, the Thelonious Monk story, playing at the Normal Theater on Friday night. Thelonious Monk, you mentioned his mental health, that how he struggled with that. And there was a lot of other really interesting things about Monk. His image, how does the movie either confirm or dispel his aloofness, his mental health issues, or anything else about him?
Well, you see his mental health issues played out live in a lot of situations where he's in the studio trying to record or they're on a gig and you just see kind of what happens. Coltrane used to say that playing with Monk was like stepping into an elevator shaft.
How's that?
Because you never knew what he was going to do behind you. He might play something that is totally unrelated to the tune, or he might just drop out and start dancing around, and then you're on your own there, you know. So he stopped playing in 72. He died in 82. But the last 10 years of his life, he was just kind of a recluse. And in the 60s, he became pretty popular again. He was on the cover of Time magazine in 1965, I think it was, one of the two or three jazz musicians to ever be on the cover of Time. And he was sort of rediscovered, and at that point, people were, you know, I mean, as far as compositions, other than Duke Ellington, he's probably written more compositions that jazz musicians have recorded than any other artist.
And most of the footage from this film was from the middle to late 1960s,
yes.
Right?
Yeah, it's during that period, 67, 68, in there, yep.
Well, let me wrap it up with this. You're not only a jazz aficionado, you're a jazz historian, and you're a Monk fan.
Yes.
And you've seen the film.
Yes.
What is something you took away from this film that maybe caught you by surprise?
Well, it was interesting to see some of the studio stuff because, you know, when you're in the studio at Columbia Records with Tio Macero Engineering, you know, you're paying top dollar for studio time, and the time that they wasted in the studio was just unbelievable. It's like, oh, well, here we are. Let's play a tune. And then Monk would play, just sit down and start playing, and he thought they were recording. He'd play the whole tune, and the band would join in, and then he'd go, how was that? And they'd go, well, we weren't recording that. You didn't tell us to record, you know. So it's like, and then he'd jump up and start yelling, you know. So,
did Monk come away as a much more likable even than a lot of people thought in this film?
You know.
What was your takeaway?
To me, it just showed me how hard it was to work with somebody like that. You know, how hard it would have been as one of his sidemen to be able to interpret his music the way he wanted it interpreted, and to even figure out what that was in the moment, how he wanted it interpreted. So, yeah, it was very interesting. I mean, Frankie used to tell stories about Monk. I'll tell one more quick one. Monk called him up one night at midnight and said, Frankie, we're going for a drive. And he picked him up, and he said they drove around Manhattan until 6 in the morning. He said Monk never stopped the car. Every time he came to a red light, he'd just go right on through, stop sign. And Frankie was like looking at every intersection going, when are we going to get, you know, creamed or arrested, one or the other? And he said Monk just drove in a circle for like 6 hours around Manhattan.
Well, cool stories. And people will get to learn some more when they see the movie on Friday night.
Yeah.
Illinois Wesleyan University Jazz Studies Director Glenn Wilson speaking with GLT's John Norton. Wilson's nonprofit, Further Jazz, is showing the movie Straight No Chaser, the Thelonious Monk story, the Normal Theater, That's on Friday night. Wilson and History will be playing Monk songs following the movie. You can discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock, Mary Cullen, and John Norton. WGLT.org is the first place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast. You can also look for it at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet us your comments using the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News, and I'm at Ryan WGLT. Here and Now is next. While you wait, let's hear some more music from Monk. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.